Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a prosecutor who retired from the DA's office in Savannah, but recently got back into the game to help out another office up the road. My new job slowed production on this podcast, but also reminded me how important it is to have meaningful things to listen to on the road. We'll be diving back in with a case that had a conviction upheld by the Georgia Supreme Court recently, the prosecution of Timone Hooper for the murder of Lawrence Bryan IV. This case led to changes in our community and heightened awareness as Lawrence's family took to the streets for change. I hope to interview them for this podcast and share their journey with this tragic loss. But no discussion of this case could overlook the massive amount of work it took for Agent Rob Santoro to put together the pieces of this extremely complex puzzle. Let's get started.
So, Rob Santoro,
the man of legend.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. I'm probably forgotten there in Savannah at this point. I've been gone like 2 years now, so I'm sure no one remembers me anymore.
I'm 100% certain that is not true, because I know some people who remember you, and I know I do. So there you go.
Oh, thank you.
And we miss you for sure. I mean, there's
no question. Yeah, you guys
do. But, you know, it's one of those things I was thinking about today. It's got to keep moving forward, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I brought you on to talk about a case you put a whole lot of yourself into, and that is the case involving the murder of Lawrence Bryan IV. How did you get involved in that?
So for Lawrence's case, I was actually up next in the rotation when that happened. I'll kind of never forget that, like, that summer. It was like July 25th, I think, was when Hakeem Clark was murdered at the post office. And I helped with that initially, and that case eventually would become mine as well. But anyway, that night was when that happened. So I kind of worked through that evening. And then the next day, I went on leave for about a week with my family. And then as soon as I got back, I was up, and then I was not back for very long before Lawrence was shot and killed, and his friend Kieron Brown was also shot in the same incident. So
that was August 7th?
Yeah, August the 7th. So it was like the night of the 6th going into the 7th, but when the shooting happened, it was actually like a little after midnight. It was like 12:30 on the 7th.
So you were up, you went to the crime scene, right?
Yeah, so we were around that time extremely busy and kind of like working sort of in different on-call teams, and the aggravated assault group, which they kind of had tried to do with, like, it ended up kind of falling apart the way they did it, because they tried to do it with like five people, but anyway. They were trying to figure out a way to give a little bit of a break to us on like the on-call schedule. And so they kind of did it in three different teams of five. And so when that happened, when Lawrence's incident happened, I was on call and for the homicide, but the group that I ended up working kind of the scene with was the aggravated assault group, which, you know, as they developed, ended up becoming a lot of good investigators, but like Eskezy Baker, Mike Rowan, Eric Blazer, Ricky Wiggins. But at the time, those guys were all pretty young. So I was working the scene, at least with the investigative group, with some younger guys. And then at the scene, I think I had Kat Lawson and Todd Selva was there with me. And then later on, Jenna Rojas. So I had a pretty decent group to work with, but yeah, so it was not like the normal group that I would get called out to a scene with, but it didn't really play a huge role one way or the other, at least that night.
You were very experienced at that point though, right?
Yeah, you know, I think when I kind of look back, I sort of think I was probably, you know, I know we always improve and learn new skills and all that kind of stuff, but I feel like I was probably just about in my prime investigatively at that point. I think I had worked like a dozen murders primary myself up to that point. And so like going into it, I felt like I knew what I was doing and I felt comfortable. And, you know, when I got there, I heard that there was a surviving victim. So, you know, you go into it and you kind of assess what you've got and you're like, all right, I got a surviving victim. That's good. Cause they can kind of tell you what happened. So that's a lead, right? And you've got some shell casings and all this kind of stuff. So you got some forensic evidence to work with. And so initially I kind of was sort of confident about it, just the initial call out. Cause it was like, you know, every time you got a surviving victim that at least can tell you the story, that's big compared to just like a body in the street where nobody can tell you anything. So I felt pretty decent about that. But it wasn't long after that, that I think Baker had taken an initial statement from Kieron Brown at the hospital. And they were saying that they had masks on and stuff. So we still got a decent story about what happened, but no real information on suspects.
Well, and when you got out to the scene, this was pretty chaotic, right?
Yeah, so it happened on Duane Court, which is kind of like a dead-end circle full of like four-unit apartment buildings. I don't know how many there are. There might be like 12 of them or something down that side. And, you know, initially, and this ended up being a big kind of, I don't want to say point of contention, but this ended up being a big kind of deal as things played out, especially early on with Lawrence and his family. So Lawrence was shot and then they put him into a private vehicle to drive him to the hospital. And when the initial officers first got there, they didn't know who was who. They didn't know if it was a suspect vehicle fleeing or what. So they ended up stopping the car on the way to the hospital. And then it wasn't very long, but they stopped it. They realized there was injured people in the vehicle. And then they like continued to escort the car to the hospital. But there was all kinds of moving parts. People were leaving. We ended up finding out, you know, within the first couple, well, really the first day that Lawrence and Kieron had been in a gambling house in one of the apartments. And so there was a bunch of other people gambling in that same apartment and they were all leaving, they were fleeing. So the patrol officers ended up blocking off the street to kind of shut it down and help prevent people from leaving. There was a lot going on.
And you're absolutely right. I think there was a lot of thought that may have contributed to Lawrence not getting medical attention quickly. But I don't think in talking to the doctors and in talking to everybody that was involved in this, I don't think that brief traffic stop contributed in any way because he really badly injured. This scene, and you know, obviously I got involved in it late and we'll talk about that a little bit. But this scene, you know, once we were looking at it, you talked about some forensic evidence, but there's a whole lot of people at that scene that were not wanting to help the police, right?
Yeah, there were a couple people. Jonathan Cheever comes to mind. He was actually in they called him Jefe. But anyway, he was at the scene and he was trying to leave. And when the officers blocked the street, he was not able to leave at that point. So I ended up being able to talk to Jonathan. And he didn't really want to say too much. I at least got out of him that he was with Lawrence prior to the shooting and he pointed out what apartment they were in. So that at least gave me a nexus to where they were, which became important because Lawrence ended up having a gun that was fired during this incident. So due to that information, we were able to secure that apartment and do a search warrant on it. And recover some other evidence. But other than that, he didn't really want to say too much. He never gave me like a formal interview. I got like basically what I could on the side of the road with him, which wasn't a whole lot. It's just really kind of unhelpful. And then in the mix of all this too, you had a group of kids that like ran from the cops through a fence onto like, I forget what that neighborhood is, but it's going towards Skidaway. It's like through the fence, and you had a bunch of kids that ran away from the cops. And so we didn't know if they were involved and if they were suspects. And one of those individuals was Dominique Daniels, for, you know, anybody familiar with violent crime in Savannah might recognize that name, without going into too much detail, because he's got some pending stuff going on. But anyway, so there was all of these things that were just like, you know, happened within like 5-10 minutes. So.
Well, and that's your job, right? Is you got to make sure, first of all, you know what's going on, that you kind of control that a little bit, because, you know, that you've got at least, you know, like get statements from people, figure out like who's who, what's what. But you also have to run down and rule people out. And so, yeah. Like, that was a major part of your investigation, was ruling out Dominique Daniels. Is that right?
That's correct. So early on, and it got kind of out that he was around there at that time. And so a lot of information early on coming back to me from, you know, people in the street was that Dominique Daniels was involved with it. And a big part of that was just because he'd been stopped by the police, and people saw him be stopped by the police right there. They ended up kind of pulled in after the shooting, and got out, and we got that through some interviews. But yeah, we ended up doing search warrants on the vehicle they came in, the house that they went to afterwards. We did a whole bunch of work, just to exclude him as the suspect here.
Right. So yeah, if I remember right, there was an alibi.
Yeah. Correct.
And y'all were able to like even get like the surveillance video and that kind of stuff to confirm that he was not our shooter.
Correct. Yeah, they were at a Walmart and then ended up coming back after the shooting. So that was between the surveillance cameras and then timing the drive. Like, we had to do all that.
Well, and you mentioned early on that like Lawrence and Kieran Brown had been at this apartment gambling. Whole bunch of people were there, right?
Yeah.
Did those people want to talk to you?
No, and actually, I think that I identified everybody in the apartment, but I want to say that like Ricardo and Kieran were the only ones that ever like sat down and gave me an interview. I tried to talk to some of those other guys, but nobody would talk to me about any of it. So, you know, there was really only those two guys that talked to me. There was, I guess, that kid, I know they called him California, the guy that was renting the apartment, the younger right. kid, the Savannah State student, I forget, Christopher mm-hmm. something was his name. He also talked to me, but, you know, he was kind of, I would say, a little bit peripheral. He was sort of like renting the apartment for cheap, but on the condition that like he would let these guys like go to his apartment and like gamble inside. So he was kind of like, I don't know what you want to call that, like a
enabler.
Like a tenant, like gambling house tenant. I don't know, like something like that anyway. But yeah, but he did talk to me too. But really, Ricardo Saab was a big help. He was the one that actually drove Lawrence and Kieran to the hospital, came outside and helped him out.
Right. This, when we got to trial with it, I felt like there were a whole lot of, not a whole lot, but there were certainly people that stepped up and did the right thing in this whole story. And obviously I felt like Lawrence is one of them. Kieran, you know, was one of them. Ricardo was definitely one of them. Tell our listeners, because, you know, obviously you and I know this scenario. I mean, we know what happened, but what was it you were able to piece together from talking to Kieran and Ricardo about what had led up to this?
So basically, through talking to them, we were able to establish that Lawrence Kieran went to that particular apartment, which was a unknown gambling house, at least to people in the area. And they went there and lost money. I think Kieran won just a little bit, but Lawrence lost money, and Lawrence was wanting to go get some more money. So they were getting ready to leave. So they left out. And as they were leaving, Kieran said he remembered, like, where he could feel like a presence almost like coming up behind him. And so when he turned, there was like two dark figures. They were all dressed in dark or black masks on, like he couldn't see their face. I think he described a hat and a mask or something. And so like he ended up, couldn't really tell much. He could see a little bit of complexion. He could give height, weight, but basically what he described happening was like both guys had guns and there was a guy in front that seemed like he described it as like being really with it. So it seemed like he was really about what they were doing. And he's
really
like,
aggressive,
you know,
more aggressive maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So like really aggressive, and like he was there to do what they came to do, and which was a robbery. But like Kieran said, they didn't really even say anything, but he ran up on him so close and so fast that Kieran said, like, I just kind of reacted and I grabbed him, and like I threw him to the ground, and like we went to the ground together. Basically, like he slammed him to the ground. And for those who don't know, Kieran was a college basketball player. So he was like 6'5" or 6" and just like a big muscular guy. So he said, you know, the guy that went to the ground with him was about 5'9", lighter complected, and judging from what he could see on the face. And then he said he was kind of light because he could kind of pick him up relatively easily. And so when they went to the ground, he said that the guy popped up really quick. Like Kieran was still on the ground. The guy popped back up and he kind of just turned and covered his head. He heard a shot, and then he heard Lawrence yelling and more shots after that. And then he could hear Lawrence yelling some more. Kieran ended up seeing one of the guys run away. So he ended up going through, there was like a little cut in between the buildings where Lawrence went. He ended up going to find Lawrence, and he saw that Lawrence had been shot, so he picked up Lawrence's gun, tried to fire it, but it wouldn't fire at the guys running away. And then he realized he himself was also shot. He did his best to pick Lawrence up and try to get him to the car to drive him to the hospital. And he was screaming for help. And that's when like Ricardo came out and helped him get Lawrence into the car and got Kieran into the car and started to drive away. And that's right around the time where they also called 911. Kieran called 911. So police were there pretty soon. So right as they were leaving was when the first officers were showing up. So essentially it was a robbery attempt. They didn't get anything from them. It turned into like a physical fight and a gunfight.
I think it's really important to talk about Lawrence and Kieran's relationship too, because this was a very tragic thing when it came time for Kieran to testify. And I think that it has been very difficult for him, the whole thing. So what did you learn about his relationship with Lawrence?
They had been friends pretty much their whole lives. So they were very, very close. It was a real tragic thing for Kieran. He not only, you know, physically the recovery and how that affected him playing basketball, but also like mentally and the guilt of Lawrence dying, him living. And I think he's got a significant amount of survivor's guilt there. You know, he he didn't testify as well as I thought or hoped he would. He did tell the truth, I think, but he wasn't very strong on like the description. Like, he was very, very certain and strong on his statement and what he remembered at the time. And it could have just been with time, but, you know, he was given opportunities to, you know, review his statement and things like that in preparation for trial. So, you know, I don't know really what happened with him there, but his description, you know, on the stand, he pretty much didn't give one. I think he even said at one point, like, he couldn't even tell if it was a man or a woman, which, you know, he was certain it was a guy at the time. So, right. You know, those detail things that I outlined as far as like height, weight, complexion, those were all important things when it came to Timon Hooper, the suspect. But that's kind of getting ahead. But anyway, not only just going through that and then going through trial and then the survivor's guilt, but like up until the trial when, you know, the public really could understand what happened here. Like, a lot of the case information was not public. So there was a lot of people who thought that maybe Kieron was involved, or Kieron set it up, or Ricardo Saab was more involved, or Ricardo set it up. And, you know, as an investigator and, you know, as a prosecutor, it's like, those are the guys that are like kind of doing the right things. And to see them get so much heat over it was really challenging and really heartbreaking. And then you do your best as you can as an investigator to kind of allay some of that, to say, look, like, they're doing everything that we're asking them to do, you know, but that's kind of all you can say.
Right.
And that is difficult sometimes.
Right. And I do think this was really just, and has been, and continues to be a big, big thing for him, for Kieron. And it was obvious at trial, obviously to me, but you mentioned that he got shot. Where was it on his body he got shot?
He got shot like in his upper, it went, if I'm not getting it confused, it went through his, like, I think his left upper shoulder and came out the other side on the right side. If I'm not mixing that up, it was either the right or the left. It went through his upper shoulders. And it went straight through, like, perpendicular through him. So he did have, you know, some of that, a lot of his muscle tissue, but still, I mean, with the, he was playing basketball, you know, and to the upward motion of his arms and things like that, it did affect his, you know, his motion and things like that.
Yeah, it's kind of a miracle that he didn't, you know, suffer. I recognize that this was an enormous, you know, injury, but that he didn't suffer more damage than he actually did. I mean, he was released from the hospital like next day or something.
Yeah, because we ended up, Sammons and I went and interviewed him ourselves at his house that next morning.
And we're going to talk about Alan Sammons because I like talking about Alan Sammons. But he ended up being like kind of your partner in investigating some of this, right?
Yeah, he ended up helping me. And this was, I guess, kind of towards the end of his tenure in homicide. I think it was like maybe the end of that month, he ended up transitioning to the gang unit. So he ended up not staying for the duration, but early on he was, and for a big part of my career, he was my partner. We leaned on each other a lot, and I'm very grateful and thankful to have had him and still have him as somebody, I think, as a partner and friend. We still collaborate when we can on things. So he's a phenomenal, phenomenal guy. I'd say he's probably the hands down the best overall investigator I've ever worked with.
It's hard for me to actually like gauge this because, you know, I've had such great experiences with both of you. So I don't want to rank you, but at the same time, I've learned so much about how you investigate, how to present that investigation, and, you know, how thorough and how much work goes into it. I tip my hat to both of you because you're both phenomenal investigators, and I'm so grateful to have had that opportunity to work with you. You had sent me, and this is like such a typical Rob thing that I have to mention it. Like, so when we were talking about doing this episode, you sent me like a list of things with bullet points, like things that we need to talk about. And I've already skipped some of them, and I know you're going to be mad about it. So I feel like I need to backtrack a little bit. We talked about this being in 2015, and you talked about it being shortly after the murder of Hakeem Clark. We've mentioned this before, and you know, we mentioned it in the context of Tre'Vierce Gray and that triple homicide that Allie had that year. Tell me about 2015, and you also mentioned briefly like that they were trying to alleviate some of the difficulty with investigations. Tell me a little bit about what that was like in the homicide unit that year.
Yeah, so like the volume was just not, our unit wasn't built to sustain a work volume that we had in 2015, 2016. And I won't rehash the whole thing because hopefully, you know, people have already heard us talk about this if they're listening to this podcast. But what's important about it is just like, how many cases have you and I talked about on the show now? 2, 3, or 4 maybe.
Yeah.
And like that, all of them were in one, like within 12 months, right? Like, so Tre'Vierce Gray, Lawrence Bryan, Theron Robbins, they all happened within like 10 months, you know? So, and that's just three cases. That's not all the other ones that went on or were worked. And so like when we get to talk about, like Alan Sammons and some of the help. So that first night, I know I mentioned like working the scene and working the initial canvas with the five younger investigators. But that morning, Alan came in and some of the shell casings, the 9mm casings we had at our scene, nibbing back to a series of other 2014 shootings. And
we got to talk about what Niven is because we haven't talked about Niven. So go ahead.
Okay. So Niven's basically a system where shell casings get entered. It kind of analyzes the tool marks and will generate a list of potential correlations from other shootings. So, you know, if you enter like every time there's a shooting, shell casings get collected, they get entered into the machine. And then, so when you enter new casings in, it'll compare it to all the other casings that have been entered into the system. And so it's effective in linking shootings oftentimes that where the same gun was used or same guns. So that's kind of what we had here. So the 9mm shell casings correlated back to a series of other 2014 shootings, which all do end up needing to be confirmed by a firearm scientist, but it gives you a good, pretty solid lead. And I don't honestly know that I can tell you of like one correlation I've received that was not actually a correlation, like a match, maybe one, but that's why the scientists look at them. But anyway, it gives you a good investigative lead early on. And it's great because you can get those, like I got those Niven correlations back, like within 24 hours. So that next morning I'm working with, all right, let me look at these other shootings to see, is there a suspect or is there somebody that we believe to have had this firearm in another shooting that's close in time and proximity, like we had with Laquan Jivens, and that's a different case. But so we started looking at that, and the 9mm correlated to a bunch of 2014 shootings where Alan had actually done a significant amount of work on those shootings. And that was the first time really that Timon Hooper's name came up, was because Hooper was tied into those other shootings. And so he wasn't a suspect necessarily right away based off of that. But when we began to generate other information, it really bolstered that information and really kind of gave us a sense of like, what information's good versus just hearsay. So that did become important later on. And then, you know, I talked about the apartment, the gambling house. Well, we weren't able to search that apartment until the next morning. So Alan was there with me when we searched that apartment. Me, Alan, and Jenna Rojas did that. And Alan was actually the one that found the two guns. So Lawrence's gun had been fired. Kieron had picked it up and tried to shoot it back. But the gun was not like in the lane. The gun was not in the cut. It was nowhere outside. So we ended up finding it inside of a laundry hamper. So somebody in the apartment, I think probably Jonathan Cheever and California, that kid, he ended up, I think, actually telling us this. They brought the gun inside. So they took it up, picked it up, brought it inside the house.
And disappeared.
Yeah, before California, you got it. Also had a 380. So just to like throw another gun in there in the mix. So that was also in there. But going back to the point on Alan, and just to give you a sense of like how thorough he is and how good he is. So Jenna and I were searching, and Jenna searched this closet and this laundry hamper and everything. And you know, our process is normally like you like to have at least two sets of eyes go through everything. So our practice was always like, all right, even if Alan searched this room, like I'm going to go behind him and I'm going to search it again just to make sure we're not missing him, because we all make mistakes. Right. And I'm not excluded in that. I've missed things plenty of times. And then in this particular case, Jenna missed the guns. And I don't
That's
have any
big, sorry.
It is.
And I
it
love
is.
Jenna. You know,
I do too. And this isn't a dig on her, because she is probably one of the most conscientious forensic investigators I've worked with. It's like her Shira Silva, you know. And so this isn't like me knocking her. This is me like praising Alan, because he went back over it. And, you know, not to just say, and he trusted Jenna too. So not to just say, oh, well, Jenna's good, you know, we trust her. And what was important with that too is that the Lawrence's gun had been, it's stovepiped. So like when Kieron said he picked it up and tried to shoot it and it didn't go off, like that's got hallmarks of the truth, because we understand like the gun malfunctioned. And so that's why it didn't fire back.
Right. We've got a couple of listeners, I think, that are not as familiar with guns as like the rest of us would be. So when you talk about stovepipe, what do you mean?
Well, so when like you fire a semi-automatic gun, what happens is like the bullet, the gunpowder explodes, shoots the bullet down the barrel, and then that shell casing that contained all the gunpowder, that gets extracted and basically pulled out of the gun. And that's what you see kind of fly out when you shoot a gun, and then it's supposed to load the next round. If either the gun malfunctions, or sometimes like in our training, they call it limp wristing. So like if you don't have firm pressure, counter pressure on the gun, it has it can't push back and extract the round right. So a lot of times that shell casing will get stuck and it won't load the next round right. So that's kind of what happened here. And, you know, our theory and what kind of fits with the evidence is that Lawrence was firing back and then really kind of became too weak to hold the gun. And so we think like his last round probably stovepipe. So when Kieron came up to try to use it, it was not able to actually fire.
Yeah. And I know I'm like going on a little tangent here, but, and you mentioned we had all of these shell casings. You know, there were some in the back where Kieron had been, and they went all the way up that little cut that you were talking about. There were different calibers of shell casing or different, when they were examined, went to different guns, going all the way up that little alley. And there were still some shell casings even in the front of the apartment complex. And I think it's important too to talk about how freaking dark it was back there. I mean, it was a really dark apartment complex from the
picture. It was. And I think like after this, they replaced some of the street lights out there like the city did. But when this happened, I mean, it was like pitch black. And so, you know, we blasted a bunch of lights all over the place back there. And you know, when we went back, we held it until daylight, which is that'll come into play later on. But so we shut the whole road down until about 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, opened the road back up, but we still held those two buildings in that whole area. Like, so we would let vehicle traffic go through on the street, but we wouldn't allow people to come and go from the apartments and things. And we ended up finding more shell casings out there in the grass and stuff during daylight, which, you know, we always did that. We always try to hold it for daylight because things like that happen. But yeah, it was like super dark back there.
And I didn't mention this either, but you know, it became important when we were talking about it at trials, like the back parking lot, there's a little parking lot behind this apartment that's kind of small. And I guess it was full that night. So that's why they had parked out front. They had to go through that little cut just to get in and out of the apartment. So they had to go into that dark area. What?
It was a gambling house, but like for people to understand, like there was big money being like big street money being played at this house. And so like it was fortified. Like you couldn't even get in the front door. They had like 2x4s and couches propped up again, you know, across the door. The only way to get in was through the back. And even that had a fortified, like secure, like board and stuff across it. And, they had somebody kind of like letting people in and out when they actually were playing. So it wasn't somewhere, you know, like you had to come and go from the back, couldn't come in the front. And that was the type of place it was, but, yeah, so it was dark and, you know, probably not very, far outside the realm of reality where somebody almost could be right next to you, especially in dark clothing. You almost wouldn't even see them, you know?
Yeah. And you know, we have obviously some good reasons to believe that these guys were running, you know, a short distance to get these guys being the bad guys, running a short distance to get to Kieran and Lawrence. But you're right. It would be a place if you were going to stake someplace out to rob people from a gambling house, it'd be a place to go. I think I called it a target rich environment.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You all searched this apartment and there was a bunch of gambling materials in the apartment too. Is that right?
Yeah. There were like cards, poker chips, dice, pretty much anything you can imagine, was in there.
Okay. And when we talked about those shell casings out front, eventually, and there was a ton of ballistics work done in this case, some of it having to do with the Niven that you talked about, but that also showed that bad guy that Kieran was shooting at shot back at him.
Yeah. So there was, I want to say, one or two 9mm casings in the back. And then we had the actual bullet. I believe it was the bullet that went through Kieran because it was right where he was laying, is right where his watch was. So I think that was the bullet that went all the way through him and then ended up hitting the concrete underneath him and just kind of stayed there. And then there were 9mm littered through that little cut and then out towards the front. And then you had a bunch of 40 caliber mixed in. The 40s ended up being matched to Lawrence's gun once we had collected and recovered that. And then all the 9s came from a Glock. So the 40s were from Lawrence's Springfield. And then all of the 9s were consistent with a Glock. And then the projectiles we recovered, I think there was maybe one other projectile or some fragments, and all of those were consistent with a Glock as well. So we had two guns that were fired.
Yeah. So you have this case night of, you know, you hadn't directly talked to Kieran yourself. You and Alan went to talk to him that afternoon. Is that right? Yep. Early afternoon, I think.
Yep.
That was one of those things. And again, because you mentioned this, Kieran testified a little bit. He just was not as specific when he testified. And in some ways that ended up helping, I think, because we were able to play that interview to talk about the things that he had overlooked. But in listening to it, and I think that, you know, this is, again, one of those reflections of how good you and Alan are at talking to people. And how good you are at dealing with people who have just been through this horrible traumatic experience, losing like your best childhood best friend in front of you. And to be clear too, you know, Kieran, when he described it, and he did a much better job when we were preparing for trial than he did on the stand. When he described it, you know, he's trying to basically drag Lawrence to the car.
Yeah.
And his 911 call, I think that was the only time Kieran got emotional at trials. I played that with him on the stand, but he's just, it's heart-wrenching. When yeah. he's talking about help, he's crying out for help, not just from the 911 operator, but just like anybody who's there. And yeah. the only person who came was Ricardo. But he, when you all talked to him, I was really struck by your ability to kind of get him over a lot of the emotional stuff that was coming with this. And you touched on it some, like, you know, he had the survivor's guilt. He also had this, I think it had already started, this idea that he'd set up Lawrence, like someone had said that to him. So there's a good bit of that defensiveness in the initial part of that interview. How do you work with that?
I mean, I think that you just, it's like Robert Larry always says, you just talk to people, you know what I mean? It's you treat and understand everybody is going through something. Not that you understand that being in their shoes, but you know, you don't go in there with the preconception in your head, like this guy had something to do with it, you know, like, unless you know he does. I mean, you talk to him like he's somebody that just lost his best friend, and you gotta be patient because there's gonna be some of that that you have to work through with the person that you're talking to, like some of that emotion, like you gotta let them just kind of process through it during the conversation, and you gotta support them as best you can. This is something that, you know, Linda, I hope she talks to you because she'll be able to give her own perspective on this, but just that earlier that morning. So, you know, I get called out. I think I worked the day before, hadn't really, you know, I hadn't gone to sleep. I get called out, go work the scene all night, and then getting ready to do a search warrant in the morning. And I think Baker or one of the other guys had talked to Linda at the hospital, but I hadn't talked to Linda yet myself at that point. And my plan had been to finish the search warrant, because we had a bunch of resources tied up there, like holding those two buildings and things like that. And so I wanted to get that done, and then I was going to go meet her. But she called the office before I was able to get that search warrant completed. And she was like very angry. And of course she would be, right? Her son just died. And so I remember telling her on the phone, I said, you know, ma'am, I've got a couple things going on right now, but a little bit later today, I'm going to come sit down and talk with you. And she, in true Linda fashion, even before, you know, the alderwoman Linda, she says, no, you are coming now. And I said, okay, oh, yes, ma'am, I'll come now. And so I stopped what I was doing and I went to Linda's house, and, you know, it was full of people. Lawrence was a well-liked person, as is his family. And so I remember being there with Patrick Johnson. It was me and Patrick Johnson, and Linda was there. Lawrence the third was there. So Lawrence Bryan's dad. And I remember like Alicia Blakely was there, and there was, I think, Lawrence's sisters. I don't know if they were both there by then. I think they were. And just all these people, you know. And I remember like walking in there, and you know, you could just feel like the emotion there, right? Like you just, it was just like, it hit you like a wall. And it was just a mixture of like anger and sadness. And, you know, like they were, I think at that point, already pretty pissed off about the traffic stop and things like that. I think they knew that at time. I don't remember for sure, but I just remember how angry she was. And, you know, I remember telling her, just give me a chance, you know, and that, you know, telling her that we were working on things. And I remember Lawrence Bryan the third just very heavy, but like from the beginning, just, I always felt like he welcomed me, and I'll always be grateful to him for that and his support and love, because he, you know, even at the beginning, he did play an important, I think, part in bridging some of that emotional gap, you know, because Linda was just so angry and rightly so. But I remember telling her, and this ended up playing out later on, but I was telling her, like, look, there's a lot going on. We work these cases as a team. You know, if you think of it like football, like there's a lot of players on the field. I'm the quarterback. I kind of look over the field and assess what's going on and give direction and call the plays and things like that. And she didn't even really let me finish. And she says, you better not fumble. And so at the end of everything, I remember asking her, I was like, Linda, did I fumble? You know, and she was like, no, you didn't. But like, that was kind of, so that ended up becoming like an ongoing joke throughout our, you know, friendship and relationship. And was always like, you better not fumble, you know? And so that was an interaction that I had with Linda and her family in Lawrence before even Kieron. So you just gotta, if you do this job, you just gotta accept that all of those things are going to be part of it, and you can't take any of it personally. And, you know, just be open and as honest as you can be with people. But, you know, like our relationship went kind of from that awful moment together to like working together in the community. You know, Linda and Lawrence started their foundation, which I know they did, they just kind of disbanded it. But I mean, just talk about like doing so much more positive out of that and kind of growing to an understanding and respect for each other and the work that everybody does. It's just, you know, it's this case to me is so important in those kinds of ways, just the relationships you can build with people out of these incidents and how they happen and how we can move on together and support each other. And, you know, cause very easily, like I could have seen like another investigator, like, you know, leave that meeting with a family like that and just kind of shut down from it. And, you know, and that's not the way to be. But you have to be like cognizant and know how to manage it, because had we not been able to kind of work through those things and like understand all of the emotion, then none of these other good things may have ever happened. Right. Like, I don't know.
Right. And we're going to talk about how important Linda and Lawrence and their ties to the community and their, you know, willingness to, you know, do what, get out there and shake all the trees and all the bushes and whatever, how much of a difference that made in this investigation too. When you talk about that, Lawrence, when I've talked to him, he always talks to about you as being the MVP. So obviously that joke is still, you know, like still rolling. And Linda, I do hope to have her on. I did talk to them, gosh, it's now a while ago. But I have some recorded interview with them that I might get permission to use if they're not able to actually, you know, join on the podcast. But this case, you're right. They turned this really horrible tragedy into something where, you know, they're working for change and they're working in the community. And that is something I don't know any way other than to say I have so much respect for both of them, for how they have, you know, they don't shy away from the fact that this has been incredibly painful, but, you know, they've taken that and made something positive out of it. And it's remarkable. It's really extraordinary. You talked to Kieron and you talked about the emotional part of it. I remember listening to that interview, and Alan did some things, and I've seen him do this, and I just love the way he interviews people. So I've got to mention that this is how he does, you know, I've seen him do this kind of thing in several interviews where he just very quietly and calmly breaks it down to like, okay, you say these guys have masks on, what do they look like? You know, were they covering the head? Were they covering the whole head? You know, just, and he'll go through it step by step in this very calm, gentle, like talking to, you know, somebody that could, you know, it's almost like talking to a wild animal, you know, like it's almost like he's, you know, when you've got like a horse that's going to shy away, you just kind of, okay, we're going to calm this down, right? And it is remarkable how productive that is. And I got to play that for the jury, which I love, because I think that so much, and this has been the media pushing this narrative of negative police everything. What you do is so hard. And they don't, the media doesn't acknowledge that in any way. They don't acknowledge, you know, how hard it is. You know, I'm just imagining that you going to Linda's house the whole time, you've got like these 50 things running in your head. It's like, I could be, you know, typing up this warrant. I could be doing all these other things. And yet you're still very present and direct, and you don't let that overwhelm you. And I've seen that with Alan, and I've seen it with, you know, some other detectives. And I do think that most officers bring that calm structure. And I don't think that you get any credit for it. And it bucks the crap out of me. And so that's part of the reason I started doing this podcast, because I don't think people appreciate or acknowledge what you do.
And, you know, you have to be that way, because it's like, yeah, you've got these other things that you've got to do, but like, you also have to understand, like, for these people, this is like the most probably traumatic thing they've ever had to go through. Right. And you just got to be a little bit empathetic about that and kind of understand, like, look, this is a big freaking deal. And like, I need to respect and appreciate that and be present for them for what they need. And you talk about like Sammons's ability to talk to folks. And I mean, he's just got like this uncanny ability to like really read people and understand what they need and what kind of communication they need. I like to think that I'm okay at it. I think takes me a little bit longer to figure out exactly what people need sometimes. But I mean, you know, I've seen him walk into an interview room and be just like calm and soft like that. And then he walks across the hall and immediately he's like more aggressive and a little bit louder, because sometimes that's what people need, you know. And he's just got that ability to flip that switch back and forth because he knows what the people need or whatever kind of communication is going to be most effective for that individual. And I mean, he can play all the roles, and it's just it is kind of a beautiful thing to watch. I don't know that I've seen really anybody else do it the way he does. You know, I really don't.
I'm 100% with you. And you talk about that sense. I had, I think my first murder trial with him, he was on the stand and I asked him a question like that. Like, did you get a sense from talking to this witness that was not accurate or whatever? And it drew an objection, right? And you're laughing because you know what I'm talking about. It draws this objection. I think it's John Rodman jumps up and he's like, he can't talk about his sense. He's not Spider-Man. And my response in front of the jury and in front of Judge Walmsley was, he might be. And that made it to that opinion on that case, and it made me so happy. I almost got the Georgia Supreme Court to call him Spider-Man. That made me super happy. But, you know, I get to work with, and I think I said this, like, we were working on some other murder trial that we were getting ready on. I was like, I have all the superheroes. I have Spider-Man. You're like hanging upside down in a cave like Batman, you know, like going through all this stuff like all night long. You know, I get everybody is awesome. And I mean that, because y'all, people don't get it. They just don't get how hard this job is and how much of yourselves you put into it. So I just am hats off, seriously. So getting back to Kieran, y'all get some information from him, and that of course ends up being important later. And again, those things about the skin tone and how much he could see, the fact that he knew they had gloves on, you know, indicated that he knew there was a break, like he could see skin, and that was followed up on. And all of that ended up being descriptive of Timon Hooper.
Yeah. And like, you know, the going back to like the Dominique Daniels stuff, I mean, that it was not consistent with Dominique Daniels. He's a taller kid. Just, you know, so those things are ended up being critical. So yeah, and it was almost like, I mean, spot on. I think in the interview, he estimated, he's like, I think Alan asked Kieran, well, how tall was he? And Kieran looked at Alan and was like, about your height. And he's like, I'm like 5'9". He's like, yeah, probably about 5'9". And like, Hooper's 5'9". You know, like, it's just, I don't know. Yeah. Those little things.
Right. But those little things made this case phenomenal. And you know, the meticulousness with which you all put this together, particularly you, and I know that you lived with this way longer than anyone else. Well, in a completely different way, because I don't want to in any way discount the family's experience, because it's completely different. But as an investigation, you lived with this for a very long time, because it didn't, you know, it did not get resolved right away. In part,
it's because, like, and then it's, there's not going to be a slam dunk unless you get somebody with a weapon and a confession, right? Because it's like, it's a stranger robbery. So they didn't know each other. And they got masks and stuff on. So you got like a little bit of ballistic evidence there. And like, that's it.
Yeah. So time goes on. August of 2015, more murders happen, including Theron Robbins was in August, wasn't he?
No, Theron would have been June of 2016, but okay. Interestingly, Marquel Banner was murdered in the Fred Wessels projects, for which Dominique Daniels was a suspect and is currently pending trial on that case. So a week later, Dominique Daniels ends up involved in another homicide incident. And so, as you can see, how all that continues to play out and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, just a lot. And then I think there was the end of August was also when I got that home invasion attempted rape case on West Park Avenue, and that was like another major case that I had. So it was just like, it just kept coming and just kept coming.
And that Marquel Banner, and it became important, or became like just that, you know, one of those little details that led to Timone Hooper talking about this case.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Timone and his group were out of like Hitch Village and Fred Wessels. So as that murder happened in their neighborhood, it kind of got, I guess, people were just talking about all the violence they had done. So
right,
he ended up talking about this incident, Timone did, after the Marquel Banner case happened.
Right. And that was important. The fact that he was talking about it is that he got overheard.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple people heard what he was saying.
And the people that heard, somehow that information got back. It got back to Linda first, right?
No. Well, kind of at the same time. So, Malika, I'm not sure if she reached out to Linda first or to me first, but the first I heard of the information was when Malika called our office and asked for me. And that was the first I'd heard of it, but it was like kind of on the heels of that, I got a call from Linda too. So I'm not sure if she called me, then Linda called me, or she told Linda, then called me, and then Linda called me. I'm not really sure how it played out, but the first I heard of the information was from Malika herself. And we ended up setting up an actual meeting and interview and stuff like that. So we went and talked to her. And what was kind of important there was I'd actually met Malika before, and this kind of goes back to, you know, just the relationships I was talking about with this case. I mean, I had met Malika like 2 years earlier. Her cousin Michael Wilson was murdered in Fraser Homes. That ended up being Pujala's case, and I helped John Pujala work that case. They used to call him Mike Rudy. And so they ended up having a vigil for Mike Rudy over in Fraser shortly after his death, just a, like a vigil or candlelight. And John didn't go to it because John doesn't go to those things, but I went to it just to kind of pay my respects and sort of stay in the back. Like, you know, I don't get up there, but I kind of stay in the back in case anybody wants to talk or has questions or whatever. And I remember Malika, she actually came up to me and was talking to me for a little bit at that vigil. And I ended up, you know, giving her my card and that kind of thing. Just saying, you know, hey, you know, if you ever need anything or you got questions, let me know. And, you know, then 2 years later, you know, she calls with this information about, you know, about hearing Timon talk about Lawrence Bryan's death. And it was just one of those things that kind of resonated with me because it was like she ended up saying that, you know, she heard it and then like she gave it like a day to think on it, on what she wanted to do with that information, whether she was going to say anything or not. And then she decided that she was going to do the right thing and reach out. And part of her decision was that she remembered me from Mike Rudy's vigil. And so I just wonder all those things, like, had I not gone to Mike Rudy's vigil, had I not talked to her, would this case have ever resolved? I don't know, though. I don't have all the answers to that kind of thing. But, you know, when these things happen and these things play out the way they do, it's just kind of, it's the reasons they stay with you, I guess, you know what I mean? And sure. So, yeah, like this case was like all about relationships and just people working together and trusting one another. And that's one of the things that I always worked really hard to do in my job. And I still think I do. And that's why it's important.
Malika, and that obviously was important and is important. And you do that stunningly well. You know, when you start talking about, I think everyone's forgotten me. It's like, I guarantee you that's not true. But Malika was, to me, and especially when it came time for trial, she was just a hero. She came forward, and when you talked to her, and she said this again when she took the stand, she was like, it bothered me so much the way he was just talking about taking a life like it's nothing.
Yeah.
And she wasn't going to live with it. She couldn't live with it. And mm-hmm. I wish we had a community full of people like her. What a remarkable woman. It's fabulous. And I know that she's not perfect, and I know, you know, just all the things, and that's not really my point. My point is that moral center that she showed is so important. It's just so important.
Yeah. And it was, you know, down to like, I mean, very descriptive the way he talked about it. He talked about, she said, yeah, like he bammed him on the ground. So like, that's when we think back about what Keyron said about picking him up and going to the ground. So she talked about that, talked about, you know, it being a robbery, they could have just given it up, all kinds of specific things. And then, I mean, she gave a date and a time. She was like, this was like 2 days ago at like 9:30 at night, around 9:30 at night. And so, and she knew like Hooper's phone number. She knew his car that he drove, the license plate. Like, she knew so much information about him. And, you know, so I ended up, that was one of the things I did, was like, I got his phone records for, you know, the two nights ago at 9:30. And like, sure as shit, his phone is right there in Fred Wessel's, where she said this conversation happened. So like, you know, just very, very compelling. And then of course, like, we didn't tell her a name, like we didn't say anything. She's the one that came with the name. But like, as soon as she said it, it was like, all right, we got something here. Between the ballistics we knew were involved in these other shootings matching, and now we've got, you know, an ear witness that's hearing him talk about it with case specific details and intimate knowledge of him. Which really, you know, Brittany Boston, her friend or girlfriend, also had probably even more intimate knowledge of him. I think Malika just kind of had exposure to him, but through Brittany, had really close exposure. And so they had all the means to have been there to overhear this conversation. So yeah. it was super compelling.
And she also was very specific about who he was talking to, who was in the group, Carlos Richardson, we're going to talk about Los at some point, because, you know, he is right there in this, and you know it as well as I do. I mean, there's just so much stuff that we could not get into a trial. And we've got to talk about all of that ballistics at some point, all those 2014 cases. But, you know, the thing that's hard about this case, and I think we talked about it like via text beforehand, we're going to have to do more than one episode just on this investigation, just because this case has that thing I refer to, that sprawl, you know, it's so interrelated with other things and other cases, and it reaches back to like old Hitch Village Posse. I mean, there's just so much stuff in here. That when you're investigating something, it's hard to know which rabbits to chase and which not, right? But this was like a huge one, Malika. And you know, Brittany also came forward. I think she was more reluctant because she knew him. She knew Timon better.
Her family was close with his family, and she was a little bit more reluctant. The initial interview with her, she was pretty comfortable, I think, but as things got closer to trial and things like that, she didn't really want a part of it. And that's because of her living situation and the families being close. And I mean, honestly, you know, Malika had a little bit of space from that area and from those people when she wanted it. But Brittany just didn't, she didn't have the means to get out, or, you know, she was just entrenched there. So, I understand her reluctance, but, you know, I'll never forget. Brittany might hate me, but, you know, when the time came and she had to take the stand, she told the truth, man. And so I won't say a bad word about Brittany Boston, man. She did the right thing. And she was honest. Yeah. So I know she was mad at me a whole bunch about it, but that comes with the territory, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and this case involves scary dudes. So it's understandable, the fear. And I think that was one of the things that Malika really brought home for the jury, is, you know, she's not part of that world. She was visiting, kind of thing. Yeah. And she could say, like, this isn't okay. This is not okay. The way people are so afraid they won't come forward. That's why it keeps happening. It's why this keeps getting hidden. She was remarkable, but it wasn't enough on its own.
You're
laughing at me, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
not if you present it to Christy Barker at the major case unit at the DA's office, it's not enough.
No, and we do need to talk about how I did get involved in this. And it wasn't even that early, I don't think. You brought this case and Hakeem Clark's case to the office for review. And we had talked about them beforehand, but it was to the whole major case unit. You presented both of them. And I remember, because I think you would run into some investigative walls with both cases. And I remember, like, I was talking about it before, I was talking about it after, and, you know, like, which of these cases would you, like, take? And like, I was like, oh, yeah, like, Hakeem Clark, there's a fingerprint. I'd be interested in that one. And of course, neither one of them was assigned to me eventually. I mean, Frank got involved in this one initially, and Frank Pennington, and then Isabel got the case involving Quezon Lee, which we're not really going to get into any detail with, but because again, that's still pending. But you know, that the murder of Hakeem Clark, and I'm like, oh well, you know, I didn't end up with either of them, but I'll talk to you about it, because we'd obviously talked about it and talked about how the investigation went, and I remember your presentations, and I'm like, oh well, if I'm going to get involved in one, I ended up with both.
Yeah, you did, but it was funny because, yeah, like, So I didn't present it right after Brittany and Malika. You know, I did some of the follow-up work, and then we ended up, and I'm sure you'll get into this, you know, here shortly, but like, so Timon Hooper was ended up getting arrested the end of October on a gun and drug case, like a separate kind of companion case that we had going on. And so it was after that, and after some of the jail calls and things like that, was when I presented the case. And then, you know, it was kind of like, I knew it wasn't super strong, but I felt like it was there, you know? And so like, I presented it at the time, not only because, like, you know, we'd like to have you guys' blessing before we pull the trigger on a murder arrest, or at least we used to, but like also to kind of feel out like who had an interest in it. And really, like, I want to say, like, it was like, I think Jenny and Frank were the only ones that had like anything positive. Everybody else was like, this case sucks, pretty much. I mean, you didn't say that outright, but like, that's how I felt. And I was like, damn, man, like, I've been working my ass off on this case. Like, it's not that bad. You know what I mean? Like, we got all this kind of stuff, like, especially if we can get the ballistic evidence in, you know, to trial, like, if we can find a way to get it in, then like, it bolsters the identification. And
we, you know, did not use that evidence at trial.
We didn't. No, we did not.
You're still mad at me about that, aren't you?
Well, I mean, it worked out, but I just feel like that was a key piece of forensic evidence that would have bolstered the identity. However, like, you know, I also understand that, you know, you're kind of like, you'd have to argue it, and then it could be an appeal issue and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, it was like all, so then anyway, that's when I ended up working with Frank on it. Cause Frank was like, I'll take it. And so I remember you and I talked, and you like, were like, you pretty much were like, I don't want it.
And well, it wasn't even that necessarily. It was more of a, and it's not like I ended up with Quazon, so it's not like I could pick and choose anyway, but I think there was just, there were too many variables at that point that are out of control. Like, you know, and we've talked about this before, I do better like gauging how good your witnesses are going to be when you sit down with them. Like Malika, the way you presented it, I was like, I don't think she's even coming. You know, and so without that, or, and you don't know how strong they're going to be either. And I think at that point, I'm not sure if you told us that you had the phone records that put Timon in.
I would have had the records right away, because I got them. I got the phone records right away. I'll be honest with you, like, after I presented it, not a lot changed, other than when we arrested Hooper later in January of 17, and then he gave a statement. That made things a lot different. But that was really between the time that, I mean, I was doing other things, right? Like there was things that I was doing, but none of those things were like major game changers in the evidence until like his statement. But it was a hard case. Like, I understood your perspective on it, because you get one shot, and, you know, it's one of those things where like, maybe it gets better if you wait. But like, you know, it was like, to me, there were only a couple cases that I saw get better with time. And that's like, those were exceptions. Most cases with time, you know, it doesn't get better, right? You lose people, either like witnesses, or you lose people like investigators, or you know, forensic people that do work on the case or whatever. And so like, especially in a place like Savannah, where the turnover was so high. But like, I mean, it was just one of those things where, you know, I will be grateful to Pennington for the work he put in on this case. And I know that he didn't end up trying it. You did. And you did all that heavy lifting in trial, because even at the end of the day, by the time you and I got to trial with this case, it was still a very, very difficult case. And yeah, I was nervous about it, to be honest with you. I knew that we had the best case that we could put forward, but I was nervous about it, because it's not the easiest case. And, you know, but Frank was willing to like put in some work and take a swing. And, you know, he kind of signed off on the arrest and, you know, got things moving. And if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have got Hooper's statement. And, you know, so a big part of me, even though Frank wasn't at the table with us physically, I feel like he was there with us at the table when trial came, because he did a lot of the supportive work, and he did a lot of the early on work and with me as I proceeded through the investigation. And he was involved with, you know, some of the Tiffany Chisholm stuff as we worked through that. So, yeah. You know, he did a lot of work on it, and he deserves some credit.
Oh, he definitely does. And I if I made it sound otherwise, I certainly didn't mean to, because Frank did a lot of work on this case, and a lot of it was very difficult, especially the things involving Tiffany. And we're going to talk about Tiffany. I kind of feel like we need to get through like that arrest of Timon, and you know, maybe that first round of things with Tiffany.
We're talking about all kinds of stuff. Nobody has any idea what we're talking about.
Right, exactly. But you know, this is how we talk about stuff. But I feel like, you know, Frank, he did a ton of very difficult work on this. And we will talk about this too, but when we were trying this case, he was trying a guy that I had tried for murder the same week in federal court, and both got convictions, and it was a great week. So, you know, such a great, great group of people we were working with. I'm really just very grateful. In any case, so you get this information, you follow up on it, you get like corroborating stuff like the phone records, and, you know, you're kind of running some of this additional stuff down. And you had put out information that you wanted to talk to Timon.
Yeah, so we ended up kind of, I forget what their unit was called at the time. They rebranded so often. When I left, I think it was like the SIU. It's like kind of like the street crimes or street drug unit or whatever. And I'd asked for some help really earlier than October. I had asked for some help right away, I think in September, because we had the good phone number, we had the license plate, the car. And we had basically somebody giving us information about when he had a gun on him and when he didn't. And so I'd asked for him to be targeted, essentially, because we wanted to catch him with a gun, was what we wanted. So that ended up happening Halloween night. So 2 days after Jimmy Temple got killed on October the 29th, second day into that murder, Timon actually gets stopped with a gun at the Checkers off of Skidaway Road. And lo and behold, the dog hits on the car. They found a 45 caliber Springfield and some Molly in the center console. So at that point, they called and were like, "Hey, what do you want us to do?" And I was like, "Don't do anything else with the car. Don't search anything else in the car. Just we'll tow it. I'll do a search warrant." And at that time, I went to the Checkers just kind of to see and look and see what was going on, which will end up being important later on when we talk about Henry Watson. But I did go there the night of the traffic stop and just kind of look, and then made sure the car was secured and everything. They did a good job with the stop. They did a good job with everything. No complaints there. And then the car was towed. And so we believed at the time that he was living with Tiffany over in, the new Fellwood homes. And, but I didn't have anything to link him there. So I had information.
Well, it was her car though, right? He was driving her car.
It was registered to her. Yes.
It's like a gold Malibu.
It was a gold Malibu 2008, kind of a unique looking vehicle. And we did have some of our undercover officers see him like in the breezeways over there, but nobody saw him actually go into an apartment. And, you know, as well as I do, association doesn't always necessarily mean that he lives there. So I didn't feel like I had enough to go hit that apartment with a search warrant. I needed a little bit more of a nexus to put him there before I felt comfortable with the warrant at the house, even though that's what I wanted. I wanted to search, but I needed a little bit more. So the night, Halloween night, I ended up going, I was with Tobar. We were interviewing Ashley Miller for the Travaris Gray case or the Jimmy Temple case. And right after that, we left. I went to Checkers, and then we went to Fellwood knocked on the door. Nobody answered that night. So then I ended up having to go back. It was the 30th.
Right. He got stuck on the 30th. The 31st, y'all went there.
Yeah, going into Halloween. So it wasn't Halloween night. It was the day before Halloween, going into early Halloween morning. So yeah, so the 30th, she was not there. Nobody answered the door when we went. And it was probably like late. It was probably 1 or 2 in the morning by then. Nobody answered. So I had to go back the next night, Halloween night. And that's when Tiffany was there. Do you want me to go into the whole thing with Tiffany right now, or
should I hold on? I'm just, there's so much with Tiffany. I kind of want to, I hadn't really thought about how to end this, but I kind of felt like, let's talk about that night. Yeah, let's talk about just you're walking up and she's walking out, right?
Yeah, so I was walking, Tobar and I were walking towards, like, she lived on the 3rd floor, so we're walking towards the stairwell, and she's kind of coming out, and she's got, like, you know, a Halloween outfit on and all this kind of thing, and I knew something was up right away because, you know, I said, "Are you Tiffany?" And she said, "Yeah." And I think we exchanged some pleasantries. I introduced myself, whatever. And she ended up telling me that Timon did stay there with her. And so I was like, all right, apartment's ours now, you know? So that's, we ended up holding the apartment and searching it that night. But one of the first things she said to me, you know, cause I kind of was like, well, look, we're just kind of following up on some things, you know, he's been arrested and we're following up on some things. And, she said, like, out of nowhere, she's like, well, I just didn't know if like a murder was involved or what, or something. Like, she dropped the murder bomb, like, pretty early on in the conversation, like out of nowhere. And it was like, all right, something's up, you know? And at that point, you know, she wasn't under arrest or anything. I couldn't force her to talk to me. But she did, she talked to me for a little bit, but then she was like, hey, look, my son is in my friend's apartment over here. Can I just go check on him real quick and I'll be right back. And I said, yeah, that's fine. Cause I mean, I can't tell her no. So she goes over there, she goes in there into the apartment. She comes back out. She doesn't have her purse with her. I did notice that she left her purse, but I didn't really think too much of it at that point, at that moment. And so then we get to talking and yeah, then I write a search warrant for the apartment. We search the apartment, get a basic kind of understanding or statement from Tiffany, just as far as like, you know, him living there. I don't think I went into it too much with her because I almost didn't want her to know what exactly we were investigating at that point, especially since she talked about a murder. And so, so we ended up getting some evidence out of the house, some like magazines, like a holster, a bunch of like dark clothing, hats, gloves, like cut t-shirt sleeves and things like that, which doesn't sound like much, but when you present it right to a jury, it's pretty overwhelming in my opinion. But anyway, so yep, yeah,
we're definitely going to talk about that.
Well, we got his work stubs too. He had some work receipts for August the 8th or August the 7th. And so we got some decent stuff out of the house, and we got Tiffany's cell phone out of the house, which ended up being a really, really big piece of evidence.
Right. And I feel like we probably need to, you know, kind of close this part out, because there's so much to talk about, like from Tiffany forward. But as far as figuring out some things, one of the things I want to talk about is what was in her purse. And I feel like that whole segment and all of the rest of that part of the investigation is something that we probably should save, because there's just a whole lot of stuff that involves Tiffany. But you got on her jail calls.
Pulled the jail calls, and they were that night, they were talking. Timon was sweating it pretty hard, and he started saying, "Oh, it's way more than just the gun," and started giving her directions on kind of what to take out of the apartment and all that kind of stuff. And so she removed some things from the apartment. Do you want me to save it or you want to do a spoiler here?
Well, can we do it as a teaser? Things that go with the evidence that you know you got, like, you know, magazines and things. But Tiffany was right up in this. And so we want to talk about Tiffany, and we want to talk about how that made this case both more complicated and much better down the road. And Frank is an integral part of that too.
You don't know what type of shit I'm up on the right now. So this shit is way bigger than what you thinking it is.
As you've already heard, the murder of Lawrence Bryan IV and the shooting of Kieron Brown left a lot of small clues, and it would seem on the surface that with Timon Hooper in custody at the end of October 2015, this case would be a slam dunk. Yet it was almost 4 full years until this case would get to trial. The twists and turns of this investigation revealed just how easy it was for Timon Hooper to get back out on the streets and put the whole community, but especially Tiffany Chisholm, at risk. Tune in as we learn how Agent Santoro was able to finally get this case back on track and hear how the delays tore at the hearts of Lawrence's family.